Welcome to The Record on KUOW. Our top story today, the city of Seattle appears to be doing an about-face on the new employee head tax on businesses. You know, the city council approved this tax about a month ago to generate money for affordable housing and homeless services. But right now, the city council is meeting to vote on whether to repeal that tax. And here to tell you the story is KUOW's online editor, Sydney Brownstone. Welcome, Sydney.
Hey, Bill.
Why this reversal?
Well, we don't have the full story right now, but we have pieces of it. So we know that the mayor, Mayor Jenny Durkan, and 7 of 9 city council members released a statement yesterday saying that they were going to consider repealing the tax. And we know that there was a lot of well-funded opposition to the head tax from the No Tax on Jobs Coalition. Amazon, Vulcan, and Starbucks each pledged $25,000 to put the head tax to a repeal vote. We also know that some polling, at least from organizers of the opposition to the head tax, showed it was unpopular. Councilmember Mike O'Brien said he was surprised by how unpopular the head tax was, even among people who had supported other progressive causes, too. And we know that there are a lot of re-election campaigns across the state this year, and O'Brien said there was concern that Democrats would lose their majority in the state legislature because of all the angst over the head tax, or pass a measure to ban the head tax to hold on to their seats. And it should be noted, most of the city council is up for re-election next year.
Mm-hmm. And what do we know about why there is so much opposition to this tax?
Money. this tax would tax $275 per employee per year from big businesses. And a poll of 400 people organized by opponents of the head tax said that more than half of Seattleites oppose the tax. A different poll of 800 Seattleites found that Seattleites were fed up with the city council's measures on homelessness. So I think that people just didn't trust the city council, too.
Businesses had wanted to put that head tax up for a vote. They had the signatures, right? It looked like it was going on the ballot. Is all that campaign done?
Yeah, so they needed 17,000 signatures to put this repeal vote to the ballot, and they announced today that they had 45,000, so way more than they needed to get this thing on the ballot. They're waiting until the repeal vote today as this meeting goes on, and we'll see if they take their effort off the ballot.
Are businesses saying they will do anything new to replace the money or to influence the process in a different way when it comes to affordable housing or homeless services?
That, I think, is the question. It's really interesting, and I haven't seen anything specific. Marilyn Strickland, for example, the head of the Seattle Chamber of Commerce, was at a city cocktail event last week, and I asked her what she would do if she were in Mayor Durkan's shoes looking at this declining general fund and a lack of new revenue sources to fund homelessness. And she said that she would scrub the IT department, but that doesn't identify a new source of revenue. We've heard kind of vague terms about business supporting new solutions, but the Chamber of Commerce declined to participate in the Progressive Revenue Task Force that came up with the head tax as an idea in the first place. So I think that a lot of the people who supported the head tax are imploring business to come up with something concrete.
Well, we're going to be talking with a member of the business community and also one of the people who helped put together this plan of an employee hours tax, a head tax. That's the short story of what's happening really right now. This city council is voting as we speak or taking public comment right now and about to vote, Sydney?
Yes, I believe they're taking public comment right now.
Sydney Brownstone's our online editor, and she'll keep watching it for you. Thank you, Sydney.
Thank you, Bill.
So the backstory is that last year the city council convened a task force to come up with a way to help people who are homeless or at a high risk of becoming homeless. And that task force came up with a plan for an employee hours tax. One of the members of that task force who helped devise the plan is Lisa Dogard, who is a director of the Public Defender Association. Lisa, welcome to the show.
Hi, Bill.
Also with us is John Scholes, president and CEO of the Downtown Seattle Association. John, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Bill.
Where did you stand, John, on this head tax?
We've opposed this proposal for over a decade, really, since it was first proposed back in the city of Seattle in 2007. We think it's bad public policy. And experience from other cities around the country is if you have a tax on jobs or a payroll tax, you get less jobs. And we think that's bad for our economy and the overall health of our city.
And we're going to have that discussion now. Lisa, what was your reaction when you heard the city council's holding a vote to apparently repeal the head tax plan that you helped write?
Well, I didn't help write the package that was eventually passed. It was quite different from what the Progressive Revenue Task Force initially proposed, but my reaction is what Sydney said, which is that, you know, I didn't come out of the womb supporting an employee hours head, you know, an employer hours tax. I, like many business leaders, like many neighborhood leaders, see the urgency of resolving public homelessness. And what is very evident is that there is no other clear plan to do that. So I think today is a day to remember that leadership is different than a popularity contest. I regret watching council members who did the right thing and actually showed leadership and did adopt a clear direction on homelessness, stepping back from that, because it is clearly unpopular. I mean, John and his allies have won that battle. But that is not the same thing as leading. And what is absent is now clear direction on what steps will be taken to make a measurable difference in public homelessness, and that's essential.
What are you asking for? What steps do you want to see from the council and from businesses?
A plan, a revenue source, and a plan. The missing piece, there's so much confusion, and it's not an accident. I mean, it's confusion that's been intentionally fomented in this political war over the tax. But the fight was not to spend more money on homeless services. If you think of homeless services are taking care of people while they are in homelessness, what is needed is a road out of homelessness. Every analyst agrees. The city's Pathways Home plan that goes back several years, the recent work by the Chamber of Commerce commission from the McKinsey group, everyone agrees that the missing piece is housing. Housing is very expensive to procure, and but there is no way around that. So we have to make some plan to crack that nut, or people will be living in shanty towns in our public spaces indefinitely. And I know business will tell you they don't want that. John says that the Downtown Seattle Association has fought an employee hours tax for 10 years. They've also said that public homelessness is intolerable.
So let's ask him.
Same period of time.
Let's ask him. John Scholes, Downtown Seattle Association, what do you want to do about housing, a lack of affordability, and homelessness?
Look, I mean, there's no doubt we need more housing across the city and across the county, and we need a clear plan to get there. We've been invested in getting to that plan, and I appreciate the leadership of our county executive and the mayor for setting a table where we can have that conversation. We can bring the business community together with the nonprofit community, the philanthropic community, and the other cities in this county. This is not Seattle's problem alone.
And John, what is that? What is you mentioned a clear plan. What is that clear plan?
Well, we could look at how we leverage public land more. That wasn't part of this proposal. This proposal was just a quick and easy tax on jobs in our city that turns out to be incredibly unpopular.
Leverage public land, meaning build affordable housing on public land, or let people camp on public
Land? Lift limits on and restrictions on housing we have across our city. You know, we can build apartments on just about, 6-7% of the land in the city of Seattle. That's not an effective way of going about this. We've had 10 years of limits and restrictions that have made it really hard to build housing in this city. So we need to
come together.
What does
that have to do with the head tax? How do those two issues come together?
Well, we need more housing within the city of Seattle and within King County.
And the head tax?
And taxing jobs is the wrong way to do it, in our opinion.
Okay. So your issue is taxing jobs.
Absolutely. It results in less jobs, which results in less tax revenue for the city of Seattle and the county and the school district and the state of Washington. We think it's a bad strategy, and we should learn from other cities that have had these in place for decades and the studies out of those cities that show that those taxes have resulted in fewer jobs. And the publics, they get this. They're way ahead of the council on this issue, and they figured this out long ago, that this just is bad public policy. It doesn't make sense to tax the jobs in your city. And the council, I'm glad they're listening now. I wish they'd listened a couple of months ago, but they're hearing from tens of thousands of people throughout the city who understand this is just a bad approach.
Lisa,
who care about this issue but think this is a bad approach.
Lisa, what about that argument that if you want fewer jobs, you tax jobs, you put a tax on hiring employees? Do you agree that the head tax would discourage hiring? And if that's true, if it would discourage hiring, is that an unintended consequence? What do you want to say about that?
Of course, it's an unintended consequence. The question is, as compared to what? In general, people don't like taxes But they also don't like the consequences of not making necessary investments in public infrastructure. And that's the crisis that we have of public homelessness. So there is an urgency about homelessness. Many of the same people who are angry about the head tax are angry about public homelessness. And what I think many people are missing is that this was an instance of bold leadership by elected officials who did change course. They made a commitment to address what really is the scope and nature of the problem. Again, it isn't the cause is not to impose an employee hours tax. The cause is to find a solution to people living in public, which is bad for our city. It's not just bad for the people living in public. And I know John agrees with that. So I want to say last fall, when the notion of an employee hours tax, you know, a contemporary version of that was first put on the table, my office opposed it, because we felt that there hadn't been an inclusive conversation with business at the table to talk about the necessity of this step, whether there were alternatives, and how the money should be spent. The tax was defeated. We helped to defeat it. Then there was a conversation about what are the alternatives, and business boycotted that conversation. I don't disagree with John that, you know, a table where people talk about what are the options, which are the best options, which have the least unintended negative consequences, is essential. The time to have had that conversation was last winter. I was at that table. There was room for the business community. They chose to boycott it. We have to have that conversation, but
well,
I would flag
them.
That it is not, there's been this other table, the one table that the city and the county launched at the same time, starting in January. This is a classic Seattle or King County process. There's been a ton of talking, and no one has named the revenue source. They don't want to say property taxes. They don't want to say sales taxes. There is not going to be a discernible change without the identification of a revenue structure. And
John, let me ask.
Yes.
John, is there a different revenue source that you want? A different tax instead of a head tax?
I think that's starting with the wrong question, and that's why we didn't participate in the process Lisa described last fall, because it started with how big of a tax on jobs do we need? We think that's the wrong way to approach this. We need to start with how will we effectively reduce the number of people sleeping outside across Seattle and across King County. And right now, the city of Seattle will collect more in tax revenue from businesses and residents in the city than at any other time in its history. So there is a robust amount of funding coming from the public to City Hall right now, more than ever.
Okay, so you're saying
being collected. So we have a question of how are we prioritizing and spending those dollars, and if we believe we need to make greater investment in what the public is saying is the number one issue facing the city, then let's look at how we're spending our existing resources across the general fund, because it is bigger than ever. So we believe the question should start, what's the most effective way collectively across King County, across sectors, bringing the philanthropic, business, nonprofit sector together with civic leaders, what's the most effective way we can reduce the number of people sleeping outside?
Okay.
How are we spending current resources? And then what additional resources are needed?
Okay, John, just a second. So look at current resources, so there's not a different tax that you're supporting. Could be a property tax or a business tax. You're not asking for that. Do Seattle businesses have a responsibility to alleviate high housing costs or homelessness or not? And if so, what are businesses, it's not tax, so what are businesses offering to do?
Well, today businesses are contributing 60% of the city's general fund. So 60% of the taxes collected by the city of Seattle are paid by businesses, and that's on top of millions of dollars that businesses are investing directly on their own in this issue of homelessness. And I can say if money were the only thing keeping us from solving this issue, we would have solved it long ago. It's more than that. This is a complicated issue. We need everybody at the table. It's not Seattle to solve alone. We need our partners across King County, both the elected leadership across King County, but also business leaders and philanthropic leaders across King County, to come together on this. We're ready to roll up our sleeves. I had a conversation with the county executive yesterday. I appreciate his leadership on this. I think he's ready for that as well, and set the table earlier this year to do just that. Unfortunately, the jobs tax debate was a bit of a distraction, and now we can get back to work in a thoughtful way, and we're ready to do that.
John Scholes, President and CEO of the business group, the Downtown Seattle Association. Thank you, John. And Lisa, any final words? John's calling for regional solutions, no new taxes. building more affordable housing, leveraging public land. Where do you go next now that apparently, assuming this head tax is going to be repealed, where do you go next? What do you want?
Well, I think that the idea that the head tax discussion has stopped anyone else from bringing responsible, timely ideas forward is laughable.
Do you want next, Lisa?
It is really, I just want to say, this is a really hard problem. And in contrast to John's description of this conversation leading to this tax proposal, it wasn't about how big should the tax be. It was, in fact, about what is missing, resulting in our inability to reduce public homelessness. And the answer is housing, dedicated homeless housing. I think most analysts, if not all analysts, agree that you cannot achieve that kind of housing investment with efficiencies alone. And so what we would like to see, I think all of us who did this work and are watching in dismay at an attack on responsible leadership yielding this this step backward, we are looking to see a similar or greater investment plan in housing dedicated to the currently homeless population so that we can all live in a city that doesn't have people living in shantytowns.
Lisa Dogard,
a goal that we should all share.
Lisa, Director of the Public Defender Association, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Bill.
This is The Record on KUOW Seattle. We will bring you news of today's City Council vote on the employee head tax when we have it and continue to follow this issue. Stay tuned. It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. President Trump says his historic meeting with North Korea's Kim Jong-un was a success.
This is complete denuclearization of North Korea, and it will be verified.
The leaders met in person in Singapore yesterday, first time a U.S. president has met with a North Korean leader, and Seattle has a special interest in this, being the closest major American city to North Korea, with a lot of good missile targets here, with important military bases and tech and defense companies. So we'd like to know if anything happened at this summit that might make war more or less likely. My guest is the director of the Center for Korean Studies at the University of Washington, chair of the Korea Studies Program, Professor Clark Sorensen. Thank you for coming in.
Glad to be here.
So you heard President Trump say this is complete denuclearization of North Korea. That was simple, as it turned out.
That was in the statement that they signed.
Yeah.
They're just words so far.
Yes. Well, what about those words? What do they mean to you? What is the symbolic handshake and the statement on denuclearization mean?
Denuclearization is actually a very, very complex and difficult thing to do. There's a guy at Stanford, Siegfried Hecker, who's a nuclear physicist who's visited North Korea numerous times to look at their facilities. And he wrote a little paper recently saying, well, what would it take to actually denuclearize North Korea? I have a little chart, and it has 21 different columns of 21 different things that need to be done. And he has it listed. Some things would take a year, some would take 3 to 5 years, and some would take 10 years or more. So we're talking about a very, very involved and difficult thing.
And then there's the question of whether Kim Jong-un really has intention of following that complicated process. President Trump seems to think that he means it.
Honestly, I think he's going to do these things. I may be wrong. I mean, I may stand before you in 6 months and say, hey, I was wrong. I don't know that I'll ever admit that, but I'll find some kind of an excuse.
What are the odds that Kim Jong-un has any intention, because he's promised it many times before, has any intention of giving up nuclear weapons?
They have to thread a very small eye of a needle in order to get those negotiations done. And the hard work begins now. The easy stuff has been done. They've shaken hands. They've said nice words. They've had, you know, kind of a media extravaganza. But the actual negotiations, and they have done some working group negotiations that reportedly haven't gone very far. So,
but do you think those talks are heading toward North Korea giving up its weapons? Because plenty of people have said, why would they ever do that? That was their goal.
Right. The North Koreans' strategy has been to say, okay, we've got a credible nuclear missiles and bombs now. And so we're a nuclear power. Negotiate with us as an equal, and we'll see where that goes. And that's what they've been doing so far. Whether they'd be willing to give them up unless the United States denuclearizes as well, or who knows what the conditions really are.
Yeah. What about what President Trump gave to the North Koreans? Trump promised to end what he called war games with South Korea. We assume he means joint military exercises. Is there any big downside to that to Americans?
Yeah, I thought that was very troubling and incoherent giveaway. That, first of all, he apparently didn't consult with the Pentagon or South Korea when he made that offer. Second of all, he didn't say what it meant. Does it mean that U.S. troops can't train now? Does it mean there can't be any joint training between South Korean and U.S. troops? Even the Pentagon doesn't know what it means. It would be absurd not to be able to train, obviously. So something more carefully crafted might very well have been reasonable. We might have made an agreement about what kinds of weapons we'd train with, whether we brought in B-52s, whether we used what kind of jets, whether we did mock studies of capturing the North Korean leaders like we've done in the past. So some of those exercises have been designed to intimidate North Korea. But there's a long way between ending war games and ending exercises which are designed to intimidate North Korea.
Okay. Well, as you say, the work begins now, so this presumably will be negotiated. President Trump, what about the question of legitimizing Kim Jong-un? I mean, even President Trump called North Koreans a cruel dictatorship. There are people in gulags right now, et cetera. But here Trump is now talking very, very in a complimentary way about Kim. How are you concerned about this idea of legitimizing Kim Jong-un?
It's something we should have thought about beforehand. I think North Korea has gotten the biggest benefit of these talks. They were isolated diplomatically. They were in the deep freeze with China. Now they've met with the Chinese leader twice. Sergei Lavrov from Russia has gone to North Korea, and now he's met with the U.S. president. So they have a diplomatic breakout. I don't necessarily think a diplomatic breakout is a bad thing for North Korea, because when they're isolated, they're more likely to lash out with provocations. But he's gotten a lot of legitimacy on the world stage. China will probably loosen sanctions now that North Korea is a less troublesome element in Northeast Asia. So they're getting a lot of what they want already.
And can we tell whether America's getting anything out of this meeting? Is Trump getting a good deal?
Well, we don't have a deal yet, so we don't know.
How about the very fact of a face-to-face meeting and a handshake? Is that worthless? The president says that they've developed a special bond.
You know, if it creates an atmosphere of trust after which real negotiations can take place, then it's progress and it's something that's worthwhile. So 6 months from now, 10 years from now, we might say this was a turning point and it was really, really important, or we might say it was a nothing because nothing happened. We won't know until we see what happens down the road.
Okay, then bottom line, to get back to where I started, Seattle is no more or less likely today to catch a North Korean missile?
Probably a little bit less likely. So
why is that?
Well, there was a real reduction in tension, starting with Kim Jong-un's New Year's Day address, when he held out an olive branch to South Korea, and then the South Koreans ran with that. And then they visited the Winter Olympic Games, and that got the ball rolling. And so this is much better than last year when we were talking Fire and Fury and Rocket Man and Dotard and all of the heavy language that people were using. And there was talk of military strikes, and there was apparently planning for military strikes. So in that sense, it's a much better environment now than it was last year.
Okay, well, let's watch it together from Seattle. Professor, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Professor Clark Sorensen, director of the Center for Korean Studies at the University of Washington. He chairs the Korea Studies program there. Good to see you again. Let's do it again.
Good to see you. Thanks.
The Record on KUOW Seattle, coming right back. Stay tuned. KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. For newcomers and the rest of us, welcome to January. We're just starting to come out of that, I guess. People in other cities are throwing on summer dresses and cutoff shorts, but there's still plenty of waterproof layers in Seattle. Maybe it's the weather. Maybe it's the hiking. Maybe it's our collective psyche. Is Seattle a fashionable city? Here to discuss are Andrew Hoagie, style and society writer for Seattle Magazine. Hi, Andrew.
Hello.
Clara Berg, a clothing and textile specialist at Mohai. Hi, Clara.
Hi.
And Dana Landon, photographer behind the street fashion blog, It's My Darlin'.
Hey.
I have yet to see myself on that blog. I'm sure that's probably just an error. But
I'm sure
we'll get that going as soon as we can.
Yeah.
Let's talk clothes first. Will you describe, because I'm terrible at describing clothes, would you let our listeners know what you're wearing? Andrew.
I'm wearing a charcoal fitted suit with a blue shirt and a patterned tie.
I am wearing a mustard colored coverall. It's denim.
Denim coverall. And Clara.
I'm wearing a patterned dress that was made in the Seattle area by a company called Boho Republic.
Now that listeners can picture you, is Seattle a fashionable city, Andrew?
Yes, I would say we are. I know there's been a lot of debate over this, but I would say we're definitely a fashionable city. The fashion here, in my opinion, definitely exists in silos. I think you can go from Capitol Hill to downtown to South Lake Union and see lots of different personal style.
A fashionable city in silos here and there. Clara?
I think that it sort of depends on how you define fashion. I think that you can be kind of dismissive of how casual we are, but there's actually a lot of interesting history of casual wear in Seattle and why we're so casual and different companies that made casual wear. And sort of nationally, casual wear had a big influence on how we dress, is that the whole country has gotten more casual. You know, you can make a debate about whether that's a good thing or not, but it is a fashion phenomenon.
So we could be style innovators from that point of view.
You could,
if everybody's let themselves go.
You could make that argument.
What about you, Dana? Is Seattle, would you call it a fashionable city? You're talking with someone in a different city, and you're honest with that person. They're your friend, and they say, is Seattle a fashionable city, Dana?
I definitely find stylish people when I'm out looking around for photos. I find that we're a lot more functional than other cities because we need to be. It rains. It's hilly. You have to be able to be comfortable and be prepared for all different kinds of weather hiking up a hill. But other than that, yeah, I find people all the time when I'm out looking for photos. And people here just make an effort to make sense of their outfit a little more than other places. Some places might not be as comfortable as we are or be prepared for things like we are. But yeah. I think so.
Well, let's see what we're talking about when we're talking fashion. Earlier this year, we had the actor Alan Cumming on the show, and he said there are no rules. Socks and sandals, though, again, not too far. Could Seattle be too casual for you?
No. I actually have no judgment about what people want to wear. So I like some things better than others. I have my own sense of style, but I think
sweatpants outside the house.
Oh, for God's sakes, of course.
Of course, sweatpants outside the house. Crocs, socks and sandals. Does anyone agree with that? Do you think whatever, there are no rules, or does anyone want to admit to being judgmental, to saying to Seattle, no, you can do better than this, Seattle. Put your clothes on.
I think that people are allowed to be. I think that you can have the right to be opinionated about what other people wear. But I do think I sort of agree with Alan Cumming with this that. That the purpose of fashion is to feel like your best self. And so if you feel like your best self in socks and sandals, I myself may judge you a little internally. I'll try to not articulate that.
Mm-hmm.
But if you feel like your best self in socks and sandals, well, go ahead and do it.
That's interesting because you could be in sweats because you've just given up, as I think Jerry Seinfeld said, something like that. Or you could feel like... That's a good way to put it. I'm my best self. What do you think, Andrew?
Are there rules? Clara, I would say that there's something really beautiful about using fashion as an opportunity for self-expression and feeling confident. I don't think, especially in Seattle, that we need to judge anybody. And I certainly think there are opportunities for Seattle to up the ante a little bit. It's happening right now. But if you're comfortable in what you're wearing... that's great, but there's so many opportunities to use fashion as an art form as well.
But Dana, are you not bothered when you see people go out to a show in schlubby clothes, for example.
Definitely not. I like that we live somewhere where you have the choice. You can get dressed up or you cannot get dressed up. No one's really judging here. And when someone does dress up, it stands out that much more. When I see someone on the street that really stands out to me, that's put together an unexpected combination that I wouldn't otherwise put together myself or wouldn't have thought of before, that's why I take their picture. That's my bread and butter. So I love when people do that, and they're just expressing themselves through the way that they dress. I think that's great.
Okay, but when you're, Clara, when you're judging internally and being too polite to express it, will you express it now? What are you thinking inside?
Well,
I'm saying it's okay to say it.
Well, I would say, similar to kind of what Andrew said, is that I think there are people who, I think one thing I'm judgmental of is that I think there are some Seattleites who think that they, because they refrain from fashion, that's somehow kind of a holier than thou, that they don't buy into this shallow world of fashion.
Right.
And so that attitude I sort of have a problem with. I think if they are judging people for dressing up because they think that that's shallow, that that's off base. That really, they should, if they're happy wearing what they're wearing, that's great, but they should also be supporting people who want to express themselves with clothes, and it's not shallow. There's actually a lot that's really interesting about clothing history and why people wear what they wear. It's a really amazing story.
Okay, I want to hear about that. Just on the question of judgment, how would we know whether that dress downer is dressing down in a holier-thou judgmental way or being their best self?
I guess you'd have to talk to them.
Yeah.
That would be very un-Seattle to start a conversation out of nowhere.
Josh on Facebook says, fashion implies that there is a popular trend, but can 40 years of Birkenstocks with socks and overpriced Patagonia jackets be trendy? I think not, says Josh. Seattle has to be the worst dressed city in the U.S. Even PDX, which of course is Portland, perfected the logger dandy look, not Seattle.
Ooh, well, I would disagree with that for sure. I think that from what I've seen, especially in the last 5 years, Seattle has definitely upped the ante. There are so many innovative fashion designers and textile makers and stylists really putting Seattle fashion on the map. I even think that technology plays a huge part in the story. You have Amazon Echo Look giving style advice over the web. You have.
Will you explain that? This is, yeah, how does that work?
Absolutely. So basically, you put a camera in your room, it takes a picture of your outfit, and I can't remember what phase they're in, but stylists and eventually an algorithm, they'll tell you if that is a good look or not.
And how much do you like the stylist at Amazon?
Well,
because
I haven't
famously
tried it, but I do think it's very innovative. Okay. And you have technology infused in fashion all over Seattle. For example, Buki Brand does amazing work with
Texas. Buki Brand?
Buki Brand is a brand by Jairo Rodolfo, who used to work at Tommy Bahama, and he has come up with this incredible textile that is breathable. It doesn't wrinkle. It controls heat. But it's made in Oxford shirts and sweaters and fitted pants. And it's totally something that Seattleites would enjoy because it's comfortable and it's conditioned to different types of climates and weather, but it is also very stylish.
Clara, you are, as I said, a clothing and textile specialist at MOHI. The H is for history. You said there's a history of Seattle being fashion forward?
Yes. Well, I think much like contemporary Seattle fashion, where once you start looking for it, you find it everywhere. Looking into the history of fashion in Seattle, I found so many people who, that there was real interest and excitement, and that there was also an era where fashion was seen as sort of a mark that a city was sophisticated and had kind of come into its own. And so there was a real hunger among a segment of Seattle's population to sort of prove that they were well-connected and to purchase things that were coming from far away. So there's figures like Helen Igo, who ran a store in Seattle in as early as 1907, was making buying trips to Paris from Seattle, which if you think about in 1907 and the 19-teens, that involved, you know, a train trip across the country, a steamship across the ocean, and she would sometimes do that more than once a year, and had clients back in Seattle who were hungry for the stuff that she would bring back, the information she would bring back. She's just one of many. There's stores that were importing things. There's sort of stylists and figures that were bringing amazing things from New York and from around the country and dressing Seattle women and Seattle men. So I could go on and on, but there's actually a lot of interesting stories about how early fashion was available in the Seattle area.
We've got it in us. It's in our historical DNA. Let's get to some tips for summer. Dana, is there something that Seattleites should stop wearing immediately? Knock it off.
I'm a horrible person to ask about this because I really don't have any rules.
Okay.
I will say my only rule is to just dress for yourself. That's where you're going to find the best result.
So no don'ts from you. Any do's? Any summer 2018 Seattle, get hip to this.
Let's get color and patterns back. We've been doing minimal.
What happened to color and pattern?
Everyone's been doing this minimalism thing, which has been beautiful, and a lot of stuff has come out of that I have liked. But I'm ready for color, as you can see, and I love when I see people in patterns and color. I think summer's the perfect time to bring that stuff out. But no rules. Just dress for yourself. I think that's the most important thing.
See, I wonder whether the minimalists were being judgy, holier than thou, about colors and patterns.
There's
now I'm wondering.
Those people.
Andrew, anything any don'ts, Seattle, please stop wearing X.
So I always like to talk about personal dressing, like going to the gym, and I don't know anything about that, but I do know that you have to start small, and you can work towards it, right? So I always think that thinking about fit and how clothing fits on your body and complements your body or doesn't is really, really, really important and can be a foundation to your sense of style.
Does that mean always wear close-fitting or
not
necessarily?
Absolutely not. I mean, I think that there's something to be said for a well-tailored suit or a beautiful cocktail dress or gown, but thinking about how what proportions are like on your body, all of us are made different, and I think that's the beautiful part of dressing well and dressing to complement your personal style is it really comes alive when you think about how it goes on your body.
Okay, that's good. We mentioned colors and patterns that Dana said. Any do's or please stops?
I would say let's think a little bit more about color. I love that.
What color? Just tell me what to do.
Oh my goodness. You know, if we don't want to like shock anybody, right? So I would say tone-on-tone dressing is really big this season.
Tone-on-tone is?
Like similar colors. So you can wear a beautiful navy pant with a light blue shirt, mm-hmm. or maybe even colors in the tans and the whites, maybe even a little bit more color than that. Sorry. but, you know, you're starting small. So I would say tone-on-tone dressing is really, really big. It's really fresh and really easy to just go into your closet and say, you know what, I want to wear something with a similar color. You don't have to think about all the different combinations.
Okay.
At least not at first.
Okay. Clara, anything you're begging us to stop wearing outside our house?
Stop wearing. Well, I would say that if you are looking into your closet and you feel sad when you're putting your clothes on and you're kind of, there's a quote, I'm probably misquoting it, but I think there was Tim Gunn once said that your clothes should fill your heart with joy. And so that I feel like one thing with the Seattle snobbishness of, oh, I'm too good for fashion, is thinking that that it's materialistic to care about your clothes.
Right.
I'm someone who, for my job, I care for a collection of historic clothes and try to do everything I can to keep them in good condition. Care about your clothes. You should open your closet and it should make you excited to. So if you're.
It doesn't make me superficial.
So yeah, it doesn't make you superficial. So if you're looking at your upcoming summer wardrobe and you feel sad, then don't wear it and find something else.
Oh, that's an errand.
Well,
now I got to do a thing,
but
I'll be
options.
Worth it.
But you have to get dressed every day, right?
Right.
So you might as well enjoy it.
Yeah.
Right. Sad that I think of that as an errand.
Yeah.
Okay. Anything you love, Clara?
Well, I'm definitely going to second the color and pattern because that there's a historical basis for that. Some of the Seattle, we have some items in the Mohai collection from the 50s and 60s that were casual clothes made in the Seattle area. And we really specialized in cotton prints because that was something that was easy to wash. It was sort of for weekend wear. And so there's definitely a historical precedent for fun, interesting patterns and colors.
All right. In the summer, my wife wants me to wear tiny socks that you can't see, and they pop off my heel and scrunch up in my shoes. So I'm thinking I go with giant tube socks and sandals.
You know what? Live your life.
As long as they're colorful. Yeah.
New trend.
This has been fun. Dana Landon of the Street Fashion Blog, It's My Darlin'. I'll be in there any day.
Yes,
thank you for coming.
I'm on the lookout for you.
Andrew Hoagie, Seattle Magazine, and Clara Berg, clothing and textile specialist at the Museum of History and Industry. Thank you both.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure.
Thanks.
Thank you all. And thanks for tuning into The Record on listener-supported KUOW Seattle. Enjoy the summer.